Right, okay, so let's start. So today I thought of talking a little bit about my own kind of reasons for becoming a Buddhist monk and why I'm a Buddhist in the first place. And one of the reasons I want to talk about that is because I'm very often asked this question. So whenever I go somewhere, people ask me, why are you a Buddhist monk? And I thought I'd just get it out of the way once and for all. Yeah, I don't have to worry about it in the future. That's kind of the idea behind this. So next time I will just kind of say to people, go to YouTube, watch it there. You will know why I became a Buddhist monk. It's actually a very interesting question because I used to think I knew why I was a Buddhist monk. And the more I contemplated this question, the more I realized how uncertain it actually is. And the reasons why, the more deeply you look at this question, the more uncertain these things actually are. And I want to bring that out a little bit. This is not really going to be so much about my own biography or anything like that. It's pretty boring anyway. I wouldn't recommend you reading my biography. It'd be pretty boring. But so it's not really about that. What it is about is trying to understand these decisions that we make in life, how we move towards the teaching of the Buddha, how we move towards the Dhamma, and to understand this from the point of the view of the Dhamma itself. So trying to merge my own personal experience with the Dhamma teachings of the Buddha, trying to understand how all of this works together. And in the process of doing this, I want to discuss a little bit our approach to the Dhamma, how we should look at it, how we should deal with it, how we gain confidence and faith in these teachings, what is the right attitude to have to all of this. This is part of this, because this is part of what's obviously happened to each one of us, while we're here, because somehow we gain some sense of confidence in these things. Either we move towards Buddhism or we move away, we have always some degree of movement in these things. And I used to say to people that the reason, this is some years ago now, the reason I became a Buddhist monk is because Buddhism is the best. Buddhism is it. This is what it's all about. This is the answer to the meaning of life. What else are you going to waste your life on something else? If you find the meaning of life, bang, you got to do it. But then I thought about it a little bit, and I started to realize that answer is far too facile, far too easy, far too kind of... things are never that easy. Maybe now, after having been a monk for almost 25 years, sure, now I really do think that these teachings are the answer to the meaning of life. Now I really do think that what else do I really want to do with my life? This is what is the essence. This is what answers all those dreams, all those deep yearnings that we have. They actually come together in the teaching of the Buddha. This actually answers all the deepest questions that we have about what life and the meaning of life is all about. But that's now, after 25 years. If I'm going to be honest with myself, it wasn't like that when I started out. Sometimes you project the present into the past and you think that the way things are now is the way they were in the past. But actually, of course, they weren't like that. And then I started to think a little bit, how did this all start out? And in my case, the way things started out, this was a time when I was still a student. This is a long time ago now, over 30 years ago. I was an engineering student in Norway. I remember I wanted to travel to Asia. I don't know why I want to travel to Asia, but it seemed like a good thing to do, to travel to Asia for some reason. There was something inside of me that said that Asia had something to contribute to my life. So I wanted to do this. And then I was an engineering student. I had the opportunity to, on an exchange program, to go and work in Japan for 5 weeks during the summer holidays at university. So I did that. I traveled to Japan. And I still don't really know exactly why I wanted to go to Asia. Maybe it was just because I thought it would be cool to travel around the world. That's usually the reason. But there seemed to be a kind of deeper desire there as well. So I went to Japan. And when I went to Japan, I read my first book on the Buddhist teachings. One of these missionary books. I don't know, those books that you find when you go to a hotel and you open the drawer and in the next to your bed and there's a book in there. Usually it's the Bible. But this was in Japan, so they had a Buddhist book in there instead. So that was the first Buddhist book I read about, first Buddhist book I ever read in my life, in a hotel somewhere in Japan, 33 years ago or something like that. And that was my first introduction to Buddhism. And that was actually already very interesting, because in there you had the Four Noble Truths, the Noble Eightfold Path, and that kind of seemed familiar somehow. It seemed very interesting to me. Well, maybe not very, but at least interesting to some way. But also, this was a Mahayana. Japan is obviously a Mahayana country, and a lot, this is true in Theravada as well, by the way, a lot of the things in this book were very kind of supernatural and very kind of over the top. Yeah, and so for some reason, even though I read the teaching of the Buddha right there, it didn't really grab me as strongly as I thought maybe they should have grabbed me. And in retrospect, it's kind of interesting that I was, almost not converted, perhaps, that I gained my interest in Buddhism in a hotel in Japan. It's kind of astonishing, because it shows you that this idea of leaving a religious book in the kind of on the night table next to your bed actually works. Yeah, in hotels, it works. It worked in my case. If I hadn't read that book, I wouldn't be here. Yeah, it's a good thing I read that book. And this was a book written by this Taiwanese missionary company. But what I also realized was that if you want to present the Buddhist teachings in a way that they actually really grab people, they should be simple. They shouldn't be too flowery. It shouldn't be too supernatural. It should be the basic teaching of the Buddha about suffering, about how to overcome it, how to find real happiness in the world, about basic ethics, why ethics is important, about meditation practice. It should be the psychological aspect of Buddhism that is universal for everyone. Idea of supernormal things is not really universal for humanity. It's not something that many modern people really can relate to. But the basic psychology of Buddhism is something I think everyone can relate to, regardless of culture, regardless of background, because they speak to a universal aspect of us as human beings. Whereas the mythology and the legends often are very specific to time and place, specific to culture. These other things are universal aspects. So this is the first thing. So if those people who wrote that book, I think this was the, what's it called, the Corporate Foundation of Buddha, something like that in Taiwan. If you are, I don't know if anyone in Taiwan is listening to this, but make it more kind of psychological. Take out some of the supernatural elements. That would be my recommendation, because actually it makes Buddhism far more powerful and far more interesting if we do that. So this was the first thing that happened when I went to Japan. And the second thing that happened, which was very interesting, I traveled around. I went to Kyoto. You probably heard about Kyoto, the ancient capital of Japan. And I went to some of the ancient monasteries there. And I was really attracted to monasteries for some reason. I thought monasteries were really cool places. So I walked around. Of course, the Japanese monasteries are very ornate and very beautiful, Japanese gardens, all of that. So I was very attracted to the monasteries. Then I went to one of the other ancient capitals in Japan called Nara, even older than Kyoto. And I saw some of these enormous Buddha statues and things that they have around there. But I was particularly attracted to the monasteries. And one of the strange things is that attraction to the monastery was probably greater than the attraction to the actual teachings that I read about in that book. Yeah, isn't that kind of fascinating? You go to a monastery, and what you really have is like a feeling. It's not really tangible. It's certainly not intellectual. And somehow that feeling, because it resonates with you, is actually more powerful than the intellectual content of a certain book. Often we are driven by feelings, and that's what I realized when I think back on that. The feeling was actually more what drew me into Buddhism than the intellectual content of the book. And this is already, I think, a very important part of how we should deal with this teaching. They have to feel right somehow, then they become powerful. We are driven by feelings, not much more than we are driven by intellectual concepts. So intellectual concepts are useful only insofar as they kind of match what feels right for us. So this is what happened when I went to Japan. And then when I came back to my college, my university in Norway, to come back again, one of my best friends at university, he had a book on meditation. And he said to me, "Here you are, check this out." I said, "Okay, thank you." So I got this book, and this book was about breath meditation, breathing meditation. So I've just been to Japan, I've just been inspired by Buddhism, and here was my best friend giving a book on breathing meditation. Is that coincidence or what? I don't know, maybe it's coincidence. But anyway, I got this book, I tried out the technique, and I had some good results. And that was far more important for me, having the good results in meditation practice, far more important than the intellectual ideas that I got from the books, even than going to the monasteries in Japan. This was what was really powerful for me. And later on in my life, when I continued my studies elsewhere in London later on, and I wasn't very happy, I was studying something I didn't really enjoy, I always thought back at this time when I meditated, and I was so happy, so at peace, so at ease, so joyful, all of these wonderful qualities. That was by far the most powerful thing that happened to me. And what that shows me now, in retrospect, is that experience is really what matters in Buddhism. Somehow, experience has to come first. Experience is what really this comes back to. And again, this is about this idea that we are beings that feel. We feel the world. And as long as we feel right, that is where true meaning is found in our lives and also within the Buddhist teachings. So I had this profound experience of meditation, and this never really left my mind later on. And this is ultimately what drew me to Buddhism, and one of the, I think, main reasons why I became a Buddhist monk later on. So why is this interesting? I want to now to draw in one of the famous suttas of the Buddha. The suttas of the Buddha are the discourses by the Buddha. This is a famous discourse called the Kalama Sutta, which is very often referenced these days. Because it kind of fits very much with our modern outlook, how we look at the world. And I want to show you that the Kalama Sutta gives a similar message about how we should approach the Buddhist teachings to what actually happened to me, more or less by accident. How the Buddha actually explains how we should approach the Dhamma in a way that is fruitful and useful for us. And this particular sutta, this particular discourse, this has the Buddha, he's wandering around the north of India. If you can, I don't know if you can imagine a map of India in your mind, but you have the northeast of India, and you have the Ganges, this enormous river Ganges, and the area around the river Ganges, that is basically where the Buddha taught for 45 years after his awakening experience. So you have the Buddha wandering around, he walks from village to village, from town to town, meeting different types of people, different groups, and they're always interested in the teaching of the Buddha. So he comes to this town of the Kalamas, and when he comes to this town, he stays on the outskirts of the town, in the woods, in the jungle, or whatever it is, and then the Kalamas hear about the Buddha, and they hear, wow, there's an arahant. There's a fully awakened person. Apparently, that's what they say anyway. I don't know, but that's what they say. He has arrived in our village. It is good to see such awakened people. It's quite nice, isn't it? Here you travel around north of India, and every time you travel around, you go to a village, and people think, oh, it's good to see such awakened people. This is what is so nice about India. They have this kind of natural interest in spiritual things and religious things. If I travel to Melbourne, the chances someone will say, oh, it's good to see arahants, is very slim, this doesn't happen. Where if I travel to anywhere, many, many places in the world, they don't think like that. But India has this kind of, has always had a very strong religious and spiritual tradition that people are actually interested in sadhus, they're interested in people who meditate, people who practice a spiritual path. Isn't that wonderful? It's almost tangible when you travel to places like India, that interest. It's a very broad interest. It's not just confined to Buddhism, anything like that. It's this broad interest in spirituality. I think it's one of the beautiful things about the Indian culture, that it has that aspect to it. I hear about Buddhist monks, I haven't done this myself, who have just gone off into a random village in India. This can be quite dangerous unless you have a really, really, really strong stomach. You have to be very careful in India. But if you have a very strong stomach, you can go into a random village and you can walk around, and chances are that you will get alms food, even from the poorest village in India, because they recognize you. You're a Buddhist monk. You are like a holy person in a sense. You're someone worthy of alms. Why? Because you are practicing something higher, something spiritual, something different from the majority of people. So for this reason alone, it can be very nice to travel to India and see some of these things. It's a very fascinating country, in many ways very different from what we are used to in the Western world. Of course, in many ways also very similar, because the human situation is pretty much the same everywhere, but also it has this spiritual dimension that very often we are missing in the West. Anyway, so the Buddha comes to the Kalamas. Yeah, the Kalamas think, oh, this Arahant, this holy person has come to visit us. It is really good to see such people. So off they go, the whole village. Maybe there were a few people left behind, it doesn't say in the sutta, but a lot of them go out to meet the Buddha. So they sit down and then they ask the Buddha. And this is the question they have. Yeah, already you can see here, it's not just about the Buddha kind of giving a lecture, it's actually about people asking him questions. So this idea of conversation is also an important part of how the Buddhist teaching is disseminated in ancient times. So they ask the Buddha, they say to the Buddha, well, we have all these holy people, yeah, all these sadhus, all these people of different religions, they come to our village. And some people say one doctrine, and other people have the exact opposite doctrine of the previous ones. And then the third party come and they have a completely different doctrine again. And the fourth party comes which have exact opposite of the third party. And then they say to the Buddha, we are confused. These doctrines are completely incompatible with each other. They completely contradict each other. We are confused. Which ones of these holy people are telling the truth and which ones are not? And then the Buddha replies. And what the Buddha replies, the first thing he says that it is good that you have doubt. It is good that you are perplexed, because this is a matter for which one should naturally have doubt. Yeah, it is suitable to doubt things that are doubtable, that are perplexing. It is not wrong to have doubt. And this is the first thing I love about this particular sutta. Doubt is okay. I think is one of the few places, one of many things in which Buddhism is kind of unique. Doubting is actually perfectly acceptable in the Buddhist teachings. Not only is it acceptable, it is encouraged. If something is doubtful, we should have doubt. We shouldn't pretend that we know something which actually we don't. Yeah, so it's good to doubt these things. In fact, if we always remember the difference between doubting on the one hand and having knowledge on the other hand, we realize that there is a vast number of things that we may have faith in, that we may have confidence in, that are part of the Buddhist teachings. Yeah, even things like deep meditation practice, deep insight, things like karma and rebirth, like awakening, things that we may not, that we may have confidence in, but that we don't know. And as long as you just have confidence and you don't know, there is always going to be a degree of doubt. So remember that. Yeah, remember that you don't really know. And when you remember that, it actually reduces some of the conflict that we can have with other people around us, because the people will challenge you. They will say, you believe in rebirth, you superstitious fool. And you say, maybe I'm a superstitious fool, I don't know. Yeah, have you ever said that before? Maybe I'm a superstitious fool. It's not easy to say that, but maybe you are, yeah? And because of that, you have less conflict. You have less problems because you understand the limitations of your own knowledge and you understand the limitations of other people as well. You can be more open-minded, you can be more relaxed about things. You don't become so defensive. There's nothing really to defend. You think, yeah, okay, let's see what happens. I'm going to keep investigating this and see where it actually brings me. I don't recommend you to give up your confidence in rebirth. I think it's actually a very important part of the Buddhist teachings. But still, it is important to understand the difference between confidence and knowledge. So this is the first thing the Buddha says. And again, something that really differentiates the Buddhist teachings from so many other teachings in this world. And then the Buddha says to these Kalamas, he says that don't follow things, don't pursue things just because it is a tradition, yeah, a long tradition of a religion going back a long way in the past. Don't follow things just because there is a lineage of teachers, yeah, the teacher after teacher kind of looking, going back into the past. Don't follow things simply because it is a collection of scriptures. This is the first thing he says. He says much more than this. I will come back to this in a second, but let's just stop there for a minute. What the Buddha is basically saying here, don't accept something, don't go for it, simply because it is an existing tradition or existing scriptures that are already there. That is not good enough for following a particular religious teaching. Yeah, this is very interesting because it obviously touches on us right here and now. If you look at religions around the world, take Christianity, because that is obviously a majority religion in Australia and in large parts of the Western world. You're told here is the Bible. Yeah, this is the Word of God. Okay, believe it. Yeah, this is a scripture. And the Buddha says, well, that's not enough, really. You can't just take a scripture like that and just believe in it just because it is scripture. That doesn't really work. Yeah? That is true for the Bible. It's true for all religions. And of course, because it is true for all religions, it is also true for Buddhism. Yeah, so when I tell you here is the middling sayings of the Buddha, believe this, then please don't believe me here. Yeah, because that is the wrong approach. Yeah, so when someone brings you the middling sayings of the Buddha, instead of just believing these things, you actually have a different approach to these teachings. And that approach I will tell you about in a second. But before I do that, I just want to very briefly talk a little bit about the authenticity of the Buddhist teachings. Yeah, how can we know that these things actually are authentic in any real sense? Just very briefly about that, because I think this is a very important point. You're often presented with Buddhist teachings. I'm actually talking from a Buddhist teaching right now, the Kalama Sutta. How do we know that this is authentic? How do we know it comes from this person called the Buddha? How do we know that this Buddha had anything worthwhile to say anyway? Yeah, was he really enlightened? What does enlightenment mean? All of these things are very uncertain. Now, so are they authentic? So the first thing to say about this, which is, I have studied this in quite a bit of detail, I've even written a short little book about this called The Authenticity of the Early Buddhist Texts, and it's available online if you're interested in this. Once you start to read these suttas and you look at them in a comparative perspective, you compare it to the other knowledge that we have about India at that time, you start to see that these teachings, they point towards a certain time period, about 2,500 years ago, and they point to a certain place, which is the northeast of India. Yeah, that is kind of, they converge on that time, they converge on that place. And there's multiple lines of evidence that point towards this. There is the language that is used that fits to that period and that place. Yeah, it is the ideas you find in there. Ideas evolve over time. Prior to Buddhism, you had the Vedas, the Brahmanical religion. Afterwards, you had the developed ideas of Hinduism. And Buddhist ideas fit neatly in between there. Then you have things like the history of India. Yeah, the history of India with all the wars and all the kingdoms expanding, and quite a bit is known about that history apart from the Buddhist suttas. And of course, these teachings of the Buddha, they fit nicely in historically because there is historical information in the teachings of the Buddha. We can actually place them historically like this. And then you have the area, the geographical area, the culture at the time is also described. Yeah, and the geographical area is also described in the suttas. We know roughly where it is about. And all of this various lines of evidence, they converge on the northeast of India, the Ganges Valley, about 2,500 years ago. Yeah, so it seems, so there's nothing really in the suttas that kind of stand out as contradicting this picture all that much. Maybe there are occasional little things, but very, very small things that really contradict this picture. And then the sutta said that this was spoken by this one man. Well, if everything converges on one time and one place, it seems quite possible that it was spoken by this one man who we now know as the Buddha. Yeah, it kind of makes sense. So I think the evidence there that these are authentic teachings that was spoken by this one man called the Buddha 2,500 years ago actually is quite strong. Yeah? Isn't that interesting? This is very interesting, I think, both for people who are traditional Buddhists, because you're not really used to thinking about the authenticity of these teachings, yeah? It kind of gives a different dimension to these things, and also very reassuring for someone who is coming from Buddhism, from a different background, because we get this feeling that there is something very authentic going on here. It does seem to come from one person. Who was this person? Was this person enlightened? Did he have anything really useful to say? And of course, the way to deal with that, this is much more difficult than the historical aspect, but the way to deal with that is to start to read these things and to get a feeling for who the Buddha was, get a feeling for his teachings, get a feeling for his integrity. Did he practice the way he taught? Did he teach? Did he speak and act with integrity? And as you read the suttas, you actually start to get this feeling that there is a real spiritual genius behind this, something extraordinarily powerful. This is what I found when I started reading these things. The person who said these things, able to say so much, things that often, usually kind of come together very nicely, describing a spiritual path. You don't really find a spiritual path quite like this anywhere else. There's something very extraordinarily powerful about this. And after a while, you start to gain this sense that there's something, an exceptional mind, an exceptional spiritual awakening that must lie behind these words. So this is just to give you some background on how to kind of look at these Buddhist teachings. And as you do that, I think you start to gain confidence. But in the meantime, you are uncertain. You don't know. The Buddha's in the meantime, especially when you are a beginner like the Kalamas are, you shouldn't really take your stand on these teachings just because they are teachings, just because they are scriptures in this way. So that is the first thing the Buddha says, you should not take your stand on. Now the second thing he says that you should not take your stand on logic. You should not use inferential reasoning. You should not deduce something logically. You should not accept a view after reflection. This is also kind of mind-boggling. I remember when I first read this, I thought, what is he talking about? Our entire lives depend on being reasonable. Our entire lives depend on being logical. Almost everything we do, every day, you have to use logic to kind of put two and two together and arrive at, usually we arrive at five, but we try to arrive at four. Two and two together usually becomes four. But if you are deluded, it becomes five. And that's kind of part of the problem here. That's why reason doesn't work sometimes. We need to rely on reasoning. What is the Buddha talking about here? How can we put these things aside? It's actually a very profound thing going on here. And once you start to think about it, you start to realize what the Buddha is talking about. To give you an example of what this is about, one of the very interesting things that has been happening in the Buddhist world, in Sri Lanka in particular, but also here in WA, is the ordination of bhikkhunis, fully ordained female monastics, And it's a wonderful contribution, I think, to the Buddhist world that we're getting more female monastics. It's a really remarkable thing, and I think it will strengthen Buddhism in the long run. But what is interesting about this is that there is so many arguments around this. Is it legal? Are we allowed? Can fully ordained nuns, can they really be ordained? Is it legal according to the Buddhist texts? Is this possible? And you see these incredible arguments based on logic, based on inference, why it can be done and why it can't be done. And you read the pro argument, it seems absolutely, fully foolproof. There's no doubt that this must be true. And then you read the against argument, even stronger, absolutely foolproof. There's no doubt this must be right. And you read the counter argument later on, this certainly is true as well. And that's when you start to understand the limits of reasoning, the limits of logic, because logic very often services our pre-existing ideas. Our pre-existing ways of looking at the world, and then they justify ways of looking at things that we already have established beforehand. So logic actually works to support things that are already there. Logic depends on the premises. It depends where we start out. It depends on how we feel about the world. It depends on existing things. And then the logic often comes afterwards. This is one way in which logic is often very deceptive. It may seem very logical, but actually it is much more complicated than that. But in another way, it is even more profound. And it is very profound, especially in Buddhism, because the Buddhist teachings are about deep insight into the nature of reality. So if you are going to build up something logical, you have to build it up on sound premises. Your assumptions have to be right. if your assumptions are wrong, and then you build up this whole logical edifice on top of the wrong assumptions, the whole thing is going to be wrong. Yeah, nothing is going to work out because the foundation principles are wrong. So in Buddhism, when we talk about, you know, insight into the profound, the nature of the mind and the nature of human beings and all of this stuff, and we talk about non-self, because the vast majority of people assume a self, logic is never going to be able to take you out of that. You are trapped by a certain perception, and then the whole logic you use based on that wrong perception is also going to be wrong because your foundations are wrong. Your assumptions are wrong. The kind of root is wrong. So this is why the Buddha says, pull back. Forget about the logic for a while. Yes, you use logic because you have to use it in daily life. But in spiritual matters, we need at least initially to be more careful. Pull back from that and then see what happens. Use another way of evaluating things before you come to conclusions about this or about anything at all. And then the last thing he says is, don't trust a teacher. Just because someone is your teacher, yeah, don't say, yeah, they're my teacher, therefore I must follow them. No, even that is no good, because following a teacher is a bit like following in the beginning the idea of a scripture or a tradition or something, yeah? Like myself, Ajahn Brahm, teachers, following the Buddhist tradition is part of that same tradition. It's a similar kind of thing as the first one, really. Yeah. So all of that, put it aside. Yeah. So what then can we take a stand on? If we can't take a stand on logic, we can't take a stand on ancient scriptures. And this is where it gets interesting here. The Buddha says instead, kalamas, he says, instead of taking your stand on these things, the place you should take your stand on is what you can know for yourself. And then he says to the kalamas, he says to them, if a person is greedy, does that lead to their benefit or to their harm? And of course the kalamas said, well, if you're greedy, it leads to harm, yeah? And then the Buddha says, well, if you are greedy, you do immoral things. Yeah, you kind of steal things, you kill people, these are kind of the consequences of greed. So is that good or bad? Of course it's bad. He says the same with anger. If you are angry, is that good or bad for people? Is that good or bad for you? It's bad. Yeah. Why? Because when you're angry again, you end up doing all these terrible things around you. Not always, but sometimes you do. If you are deluded or confused about things, exactly the same thing again. And if it is the opposite, the other way around, if you're not greedy, if you have a heart of generosity, if you have metta and kindness instead of anger, what happens then? That happens that you act for your own benefit and you act for the benefit of other people at the same time. And of course the kalamas, they knew this intuitively. Why did they know this intuitively? Well, for the same reason that you also know this intuitively, because this coincides with our experience of the world. When you are kind, you feel good about yourself. It leads to benefit of other people. It also leads to your own benefit. So the Buddha is saying, ask yourself what the truth is. Ask yourself what actually works. What works with your own experience. That is where you find truth. Yeah, so our own experience is basically the final thing, especially when you are a beginner, you come to a spiritual teaching for the first time. You have to ask yourself, does it fit with my own experience? You have to trust yourself. Yeah, you have to trust your own judgment to be able to actually see the difference between a good teaching and a bad teaching. And if you do that, then you know that you are on the right track. Of course, you also have to be humble. You also have to understand your own limitations. But in the final analysis, you have to come back to what you know is true. And only then will you be able to make the right kind of decisions. So this is what the Buddha tells these kalamas. And of course, the point here, a very important point of this, is that when the Buddha says this to the kalamas, of course, the Buddhist teachings teach exactly that. Yeah, they teach exactly that greed is going to be detrimental for you. Hatred is going to be detrimental for you. So what the Buddha really is doing, he's showing that the Buddhist teachings actually match how you experience the world. That's really what he's doing. So it's kind of drawing in the kalamas in the back door. Yeah, that's kind of what he's, in a sense, is doing here. And I think it's fair enough, because if it really works according to how you experience the world, well, then of course you should have some degree of confidence and faith in these teachings. And this is how then you move from experience to the next step. And now Once you have that basic confirmation that these teachings are according to reality, then you go back to that scriptural collection. Now you can place some confidence and faith in it. Yeah, the Kalamas were just at the very starting point of the spiritual path. Once you have passed that starting point, then you go back and you start placing some confidence in those teachings because you know that they work and they actually function according to reality. So this is the right way of doing it. First experience, then confidence in the teachings, and then you take it on from there. And now you can also start to apply logic to some extent and inferential reasoning, because you're now basing yourself on something a little bit more solid, which is again your own experience and some confidence in those teachings. And this is how you gradually build things up. Yeah, the more that you experience things, the deeper you go in your meditation practice, especially when meditation starts to become really powerful. You start to wake up. Mindfulness starts to really kind of kick in. You start to gain some of the happinesses and joys of meditation practice, which is exactly what the Buddha teaches in the suttas. Yeah, one of the extraordinary things about meditation, the way the Buddha teaches about it, is that it is all about happiness, joy, pamuja, piti, pasaddi, sukha. These are all terms that have to do with joy and happiness of various degrees. And once you get to this point, and these things start to work, wow, you start to get incredible confidence in these teachings. Because you can see, in a very profound sense, the parallel between the suttas and what you're experiencing. And what you are experiencing at this point, you're getting very much closer to what is actually the meaning of life itself. You're starting to feel that you're touching something very profound. And of course, then the confidence really gets a massive boost. So this is how the Buddha brings these kalamas around. And this is kind of the right approach to these things, especially for people who are fairly new to the Buddhist teaching, but also those who have been around for a while. You gradually build it up. Experience and scriptures kind of going together. But in the final analysis, your experience is going to have to be the most important thing here. So how then does this relate to my... Oh, I said I was going to talk about my own life, why I became a Buddhist monk. Yeah, I haven't said, so how does this relate to my own life as a Buddhist monk? Why did I become a Buddhist monk again? The way it relates to that, again, is because, as I said before, what really caught me, what really kind of made a massive difference for me in my life was my own experience in meditation practice. That was the thing that really worked, yeah? And then from that is when I started to kind of gain an acceptance of the Buddhist teachings. I started to read them. And as I started to read them, I started to got this feeling that this actually is extraordinarily powerful. And then this whole thing started to come together in a very powerful way. But what is really interesting about this... Yeah, many people can have a profound experience in meditation. You don't have to be a Buddhist. You can be a Christian, you can be an atheist, you can be a Muslim, you can be whatever. You can be a Martian, probably. I've never really asked the Martians, but anyway, you probably can be. Yeah, if you sit down cross-legged and you watch the breath, do Martians, do they breathe? Not sure now. They probably have something they can watch. There's some kind of samadhi object. So... Yeah, so these are kind of universal things. Yeah, they're always there, and so you come back to these things. So this can happen to anyone, but still somehow I was moved towards Buddhism. Why did I decide to move towards Buddhism, even though it's possible to do exactly the same thing as a Christian or whatever? Why then did I still become a Buddhist? It wasn't really necessary. Christianity had mystics in the past. Islam had mystics in the past. Why did I choose the Buddhist path? Why was I attracted to that? And then I started to realize, I started to think back on my early life. And one of the things that I remember very clearly when I was still very young, I was about 12 years old. And I remember when I was 12 years old, I had this fantasy of living in a hut in the forest by myself. Isn't that kind of extraordinary? Is that common? I'm not sure if that is. Is that common for 12 years old to have that fantasy? I don't know. I've never really heard of anyone else have that fantasy at 12 years old. Here is another one. Okay. So he is. So, but to me, I was like, where on earth did that come from? How come I had this fantasy when I was 12 years old? And for me, the only real explanation that I could find for having that fantasy, and I was mentioning before also that when I went to Japan, I went to the monasteries, and I felt kind of an attraction to these monasteries. I came to the conclusion, the only way this is possible is because I must have been a Buddhist monk in a past life. How else could it be possible? I just don't get it. Maybe there are other reasons, but that is the one that seems obvious to me. And the consequences of that, and I must admit, I feel pretty convinced that I must have been a monastic in a past life. I don't know where, I don't know what gender, I don't know whether it was on Earth or on Mars, but you know, it somewhere I was, other Buddhist monks on Mars, not sure, but somewhere I must have been a Buddhist monk. That's kind of the feeling. And it is very interesting, once you have that sense that you have been a Buddhist monk in a past life, the consequences of that are quite interesting. Because it means that rather than me choosing to become a Buddhist monk because I am incredibly smart, right? Yes, I'm incredibly smart. Because I understand the Buddhist teachings. Yeah, I make the wise choice and choose the Buddhist teaching. Yeah, because, you know, I'm special, right? And everybody... And actually, it takes all that away. It is not that you are special. It is that you have a habit from a past life that you are following in this life. You're just kind of moving on, doing the same thing that you did in the past. It takes away so much of the ego. It takes away so much of the me. I am good. I am great. I'm wonderful. We always like to think that we are wonderful. And maybe we are, but it's not kind of good to think too much in that way. It kind of, especially if you do it in the wrong way. So it takes away so much of the ego. Maybe I was just following along an ancient path that I've been doing already for a long, long, long time in the past. And of course, then once I realize that, I realize that I'm just kind of following this ancient habit I've probably had for a long time already, it makes me also a bit worried. Well, if I'm just following the habit, how do I know Buddhism is right? I'm just doing this as like a robot, probably. Have I really studied these teachings properly? It makes you kind of scared, yeah? So it makes me even more important for me to read these teachings properly, to investigate them properly, to really find out whether they really are worthwhile following. Because I don't want to be a stupid robot just kind of following the old, you know, what everyone else, oh, actually not everyone, very few other people do, but whatever it is. So I read the teachings even more diligently. I learned Pali. I was like, Venerable Sunyo is the Pali teacher, that's true, but I was Venerable Sunyo's Pali teacher before that, so I also know the Pali language. So you read the suttas very thoroughly to actually really find out whether they are all they are supposed to be. And of course, that is where you start to get this powerful feeling more and more that here you are in the presence of something extraordinarily powerful. You commit yourself even more because you know the danger of overestimating this from a sense of self. So this is the first thing that happened to me when I realized this, quite likely it is just a matter of a past life thing, following a certain habit from the past. I always feel a bit sheepish for saying that, because people kind of expect you to say, yeah, you know, I understood this, and if you look at things in this way, expect you to say something wise instead of saying something which kind of is almost the exact opposite. But the other thing that was very interesting for me when I recognized that, and it's a little bit on the side of the topic tonight, and that is the fact that if I was a monastic in the past, first of all, I don't know if I was a monk or a nun. Yeah, maybe I was a nun. Yeah, who knows? And of course, the other thing is that I would have been a monastic somewhere in Asia. Yeah, I don't know where, but some Asian country probably. And one of the wonderful things about that is that if you think of yourself as a monastic in Asia, a monk or a nun, it takes away so many of the barriers. Just underneath yourself, you can see yourself belonging to a completely different culture, being part of a completely different ethnic group, some in a completely different context, with a completely different historical background. Yeah, you see yourself like that, and you see those things inside of yourself. It takes away so many of the barriers that we build up between us, between people from different backgrounds, different nationalities, different genders, whatever it is. If you feel that inside of yourself, that you are part of these other cultures, part of these other traditions, part of the opposite gender is already inside of you. It becomes a very beautiful way of coming to accept yourself more fully, but also the people around you. And this is the wonder, another very wonderful thing of looking at life in this particular way. But just to maybe summarize very briefly, and I think this is a kind of one of the, I think, important things, one of the important kind of conclusions or outcomes of this particular topic, is that very few things in our life are determined by ourselves. Yeah, it's not ourselves that are the most important thing. That is not usually where things come from. Usually things come from somewhere in the past, some habits we had before that we are playing out again. It's like a program that was written sometime in the past, and now we're playing it out again in the future. Yeah, again and again and again. And this is part of this process of moving on in samsara. And once you get that, once you understand that, in a sense, it actually becomes quite concerning, because you can see it is a trap. And I thought for a moment I was trapped as a Buddhist until I realized that actually there is something worthwhile here, something that can take you out of that very trap that you have been part of for so long. So there you are. That is just a little bit of a talk on why I am a Buddhist monk. So now you know, you never have to ask me again. So thank you very much. Okay, so are there any questions or comments on this from anyone here? Everyone is happy? Okay, great. Yeah, you can bring them up. Yeah, that's excellent. Thank you. Anybody want to ask anything? This is your opportunity. Everyone is okay? Okay, very good. So then we will have a look at what people outside have to say. So this is from Alan in Scotland. And he says, has the following question. My wife and her family are Christians. How would I approach understanding this from a Buddhist viewpoint? How you understand that from a Buddhist viewpoint, that they are Christians, it's just conditioning, right? They are conditioned in one way, you are conditioned in a different way, and because of that, some people become Christians and some people become Buddhist. So very likely they would have been Christians in a past life, just like I was a Buddhist in a past life, they were Christians in a past life, and because that habit of believing in the Creator God is so strong, yeah, the habit is so strong, it means it is very emotionally connected to you. As I was saying before, some of the most important things in life are how we feel about things. So if you feel very powerfully, very positively about certain things, you will be drawn to that very often without having a good reason for being drawn there. And this is why I was afraid when I realized that I was a Buddhist out of habit. It scared me. In the same way, if somebody is a Christian out of habit, they should be a little bit worried, because maybe they're just doing it out of blindness, out of blind faith. Yeah, but that is basically probably where they are coming from, because it feels good to them. They've done this in the past, it's part of their identity, because it's part of your identity. It feels good to follow things in that particular way. So that is how you approach that. Now maybe you will ask, why is it that I ended up with a Christian wife if you happen to be a Buddhist, or you are kind of leaning the Buddhist way or whatever? And this is just because, again, it probably has to do with past things. It has to do with the fact that you have probably been attracted to this person in the past life. You have some kind of attachment there, and because you have some kind of attachment there, you kind of follow along with the same kind of attachments also in the present life. And sometimes it is strange how attachment works. Yeah, sometimes we are attached to people that are our enemies. Yeah, we have some kind of unfinished business. People that are problematic in our lives, and we get attachment there. And that means, which is quite scary, it often means that we can be reborn with families, with people who actually will lead to our detriment. Yeah, people who will kind of do bad things towards us because we have attachments in places that are not really wise to have attachments in. So Anyway, I hope that is what you are asking about, because, yeah. Anyway, next one, this is from Indira in Sri Lanka. Are there devas to help to make sure that karma works? So do the devas, do they ensure that the karma works in the appropriate way? You don't require devas for karma to work. Karma is an impersonal law. It will work out regardless of devas and humans and anything else, because it will. It is a force that kind of happens on its own. Exactly how does karma work is a very interesting thing, because usually when we think about karma, we think about the idea of you are in one life, and then in your next life you gain all of these things because you did good things in this life. But that is a very superficial way of understanding karma, in my opinion. The right way to think about karma is simply to think of how do you feel when you do an act of kindness. Yeah, and most people will realize when you really do an act of kindness coming from your heart, you actually feel happy about yourself. You feel good about yourself as a consequence. How do you feel if you do something which is not so nice or helpful to others? Usually you feel a bit bad about yourself. Yeah, you feel a bit guilty or whatever. So karma is the accumulation of doing good and then accumulation of feeling good about yourself. Bad karma is the accumulation of doing bad things and feeling bad about yourself as a consequence. The more you do good acts, the more you lift yourself up, and the better you feel about yourself because of that cumulative effect of good things. And then when you die, because you have done many good things and you feel good about yourself, that happiness carries on also into the future life. That is the best way of thinking about karma, because it's actually something that you can experience right here and right now. And this is how the Buddha recommended us to experience these things. But of course, perhaps what you are asking is whether other beings can be agents that ensure that karma works out. Yeah, for example, say that you get murdered. Yeah, someone gets murdered. Sometimes that happens in this world. So if someone gets murdered, is that person, the murderer, are they an agent of karma that made that other person die? Are they kind of, has karma kind of hijacked them and says, okay, now I'm going to steer you to kill this person? Is that how it works? And the answer is that it may very well be karma for the person who died. Yeah, but the person who killed them is not necessarily an agent of karma, because karma can actually happen in so many different ways. It didn't have to be that person who killed them. That person is not actually doing the work of karma. They are following their own trajectory, making their own bad karma as a consequence of their own stupidity. And it doesn't really have anything to do with, it's not karma that is directing them. They are directed by their own forces and their own situation in life. And it's exactly the same thing with the devas. The devas are not kind of the agents of karma that somehow make our karma come true. The devas are run, if you like, by their own forces, by their own habits of the past, by their own karma, and that is why they end up doing things. They are not really agents of karma in that particular sense. So I don't know if that is what you were asking, but that is my answer. Anyway, regardless, so that's how I read what you're saying, yeah. Okay, that is all the questions from overseas. Is anyone else who wants to like to say anything here? Yes, yeah, someone over here, okay.
Hello, I really enjoyed your talk, thank you. I was just wondering how we can break through, I guess, the regular cycles of, I guess, delusion that we get caught up in. You know, you chase something external to yourself thinking it's going to make you happy, and then it doesn't, and then you chase after the next thing. Is it just continuing on with the meditation practice, or what would you recommend?
Certainly continue on with the meditation practice, but it's also important to reflect on your experience, yeah? So reflect on what's going on, and gradually the penny starts to drop. Or the scent starts to drop, whatever it is over here. Yeah, it gradually starts to drop, and you start to think, wow, actually, this is, you know, after having done it a million times, you start to kind of, okay, let's kind of chill a little bit on this one. And also read some of the teachings of the Buddha, because the Buddha explains this in quite beautiful ways. Yeah, there's some very powerful similes in the suttas. One of my favorite similes is the simile of the hungry dog. There's this hungry dog, and this dog runs to the butcher shop. Yeah, waiting outside the butcher shop, looking up at the butcher, waiting for the butcher to throw some meat or something. The butcher is not going to give any meat to a mangy dog in ancient India. I can imagine these dogs. They're very different from kind of dogs that are kept as pets these days. So the butcher scrapes off all the meat. All that is left on this poor skeleton, this poor bone, is a bit of blood. Chucks out the blood, chucks out the bone to the dog. The dog kind of gnaws this bone a little bit, gets the taste of blood, and kind of gets excited because of the taste of blood, but it doesn't get satisfied. Yeah, it just as much craving, just as much problem as before. So the dog then runs off to the next butcher shop. The next butcher is just as stingy as the previous butcher. And after having run to 100 different butchers, the dog keeps on running, and again, and again, and again. And then the dog dies. Then it gets reborn as a dog also in the next life. And it keeps on running. And this is the problem of samsara. We always keep on doing the same thing. And it's actually a very hard lesson to learn. It's a beautiful simile because it shows you how we kind of get trapped in this thing and we can't see it. We never actually learn from our experience. But essentially we are like this dog that never actually gets out of it. So this is just a method for reflecting on this. And as you do that, you kind of get a bit of perspective and you pull back a little bit. And hopefully as you practice, you pull back more and more. And as you pull back more, your meditation deepens. And when your meditation deepens, you see things more clearly. When you see things more clearly, you get even deeper meditation. That's the theory. Yeah? The reality is a bit different, but that's the theory. And then eventually, kind of gradually, you move towards something positive. And the reality is that it's a bit like this, up and down, but hopefully with a trajectory that goes up. Yeah, that's what it kind of is like. Yeah. Does that help?
Yes, thank you.
Okay, great.
John Bramley, I'd love to see, yeah. You know, from your talk on how you were interested in Buddhism and how you become a monk, It just came to my mind, you know, the four stages towards enlightenment, the stream entrance, then I think it's anagami, isn't it? Sakadagami, then arahantship, isn't it? The whole thing takes 7 lives. Could it be that you come back again to carry on, the path towards enlightenment? You see what I mean?
I see what hopefully I'm carrying on the path. Yeah, I hope so. Otherwise, I'm in trouble. Yeah, if I don't carry on the same path. So I definitely hope so. Yeah, I hope, moving in that direction. So good. I agree with that. Yeah, good point. I would say so. Okay. Anyone else like to say anything here? Over there, okay, Bronwyn here.
Thank you. Thank you, Ajahn, for your teaching this evening. It was very clear and very informative. And I don't have any questions because you've answered all of mine. And I haven't been here for a while, so it's really wonderful to be here again. And it's wonderful to find out that you're teaching.
Okay, good. Excellent. Thank you for that. Okay, okay. So let's just call it a day and let's just pay respect to Buddha Dhamma Sangha.
Bhagavato Sāvaka Sangho